أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. We were talking about sermon number 17, and in this sermon Amir al-Mu'mineen described two groups of scholars. One was a group who were people of knowledge of theology and concepts, and they were of course misguided and misguiding others. And the other group were people who had lots of knowledge of traditions and were people of juristic knowledge. However, that was not a knowledge, but it was just ignorance collected by them from here and there. So the sermon began, إِنَّ أَبْغَضَ الْخَلَائِقِ إِلَى اللَّهِ رَجُلَانِ, the most hated people before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, two groups of people. So the first group we described, the second group also we started describing, وَرَجُلٌ قَمَشَ جَهْلًا, a person who had picked up from here and there some ignorance, thinking that is knowledge. And then he sits in a position of a qadi, a judge among the people, pretending that he knows the law, that he knows the knowledge of judging among the people. So here is where we left our last discussion about the khutbah. جَلَسَ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ قَاضِيًا ضَامِنًا لِتَلْخِيسِ مَلْتَبَسَ عَلَى غَيْرِهِ. He sits among the people as a judge, and he guarantees that he's going to solve all the issues which has confused others, meaning that I have the knowledge to judge. While we know that knowledge of this type of knowledge is a very, very important, crucial, sensitive knowledge which deals with life, property, rights of the people. So the person who sits in this position should be really knowledgeable, not thinking that he has the knowledge. فَإِن نَزَلَتْ بِهِ إِحْدَى الْمُرْحَمَاتِ حَيَّأَ لَهَا حَشْوًا رَفًّا مِنْ رَعْيِهِ. If an ambiguous problem is presented before them, and نَزَلَتْ بِهِ إِحْدَى الْمُبْهَمَةِ, he has prepared for it, or he prepares for it, abundant material of useless opinion of himself. هَيَّ أَلَهَا حَشْوًا رَثًا مِنْ رَعْيِهِ, shabby type of arguments from his own opinion he has. So حَشْو is when you put forward something in abundance. We had a group in the history of tradition of theology, kalam, who were called Hashwiya. Hashwiya were the people who, for every concept, they provided lots of hadith and tradition without really understanding what those traditions meant and said. So it's not important to provide lots of argument or lots of tradition for every instance. What is important is to have an understanding of them. So this is why Amir al-Mu'mineen says they have prepared for every instance. Hashwan, an abundant material of hadith and their own opinions. Here it says min ra'yah, from their own opinions. And as I said last week, apparently this issue of contest between people who use their opinion, their ra'y, and people who were sticking to the sunnah of the Prophet was completely apparent at that time even. And of course we know that Amirul Mu'mineen and Ahlul Bayt were the real Ahlul Sunnah. They were people who were sticking to the sunnah of the Prophet, not permitting ra'y and opinion in issues regarding to juristic issues. So he prepares lots of opinion, shabby arguments about that issue. ثُمَّ قَتَعَ بِهِ. Then, by his arguing these issues himself, he thinks that he comes to certainty about it. And then he issues his ruling, his judgment among the people. Then Amir al-Mu'min describes this judge, or this person who claims to have knowledge, as فَهُوَ مِنْ لَبْسِ الشُّبُهَاتِ فِي مِثْلِ نَسْجِ الْعَنْكَبُوتِ لَا يَذْرِي أَصَابَ أَمْ أَخْتَأَ فَإِنْ أَصَابَ خَافَ أَنْ يَكُونَ قَدْ أَخْتَأَ وَإِنْ أَخْتَأَ رَجَى أَنْ يَكُونَ قَدْ أَصَابَ. In covering up the issues and making confusions, or in being entangled in confusions by putting forward so many opinions about every issue, he's just like if some spider which weaves a web around itself. So في مثل نفس العنكبوت, like the weaving of the spider web. He's like that. First of all, any opinion he puts forward, he doesn't know whether this is right or wrong. It's just a conjecture. لا يدري أصاب أم أخطأ. If by chance he is right, he is always fearful that it might have been wrong. And if it is wrong, which happens in most cases, he hopes that by chance it will be right. Well, the whole description is that this person really doesn't know. He just puts forward his own opinions about every case and wants to judge among the people. جاهلٌ خَبَّاطُ جَهَالَاتٍ. He is ignorant and making lots of mistakes in his ignorance. عَاشٌ رَكَّابُ أَشَوَاتٍ. And he is blind, carrying on in blindness, riding every type of carriage which aimlessly takes him here and there. لم يعد على العلم بدرس قاطع. This is a very beautiful metaphor he has used here, Amir al-Mu'mineen. He has not bit on knowledge with a firm tooth. And it is a very, very beautiful expression. Also, he might have chewed some knowledge and has gained some taste of it. But he never has firmly bit on any real knowledge. لَمْ يَعَدَّ عَلَى الْعِلْمِ بِذَرْسٍ قَاطِعٍ يَذْرُ الرَّوَايَاتِ ذَرْوَ الرِّيْحِ الْحَشِيمِ. He scatters traditions from the prophets here and there, like the wind scattering the dry leaves. He scatters the rawayat. Now, what all these tell us is that, first of all, now Amir al-Mu'minin is sitting in a place where he is going to appoint judges as a caliph. And first of all, a chief judge, and that chief judge is going to appoint many judges. And before him, many judges were appointed, actually. And those judges, most of them, were of this type that Amir al-Mu'mineen mentions here. So he is going to have a very difficult task replacing those judges with some new type of judge who had that knowledge. And of course, when you come to administration and you want to manage a country, even if you are Amir al-Mu'mineen, you find difficulty finding the right people all the time. I mean, how many knowledgeable people do you think were living at that time, at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the type that he is looking after, that could actually be appointed as judges in the true sense? Well, not many. So he had to use the same judges again, of course. And that would have put him in a very difficult position. And that's why he's giving all these descriptions, so that the judges that he had available at his disposal would somehow think and ponder and use their understanding in keeping away from using opinion all the time, learning a bit about the Quran, about understanding the traditions, not just scattering traditions here and there. And well, certainly if you want to go and make an Islamic state, you will find all those difficulties around yourself. You want a good judiciary, knowledgeable judges, but where to find it? And then you have to use mediocre judges, and then everyone says, is this Islamic? This is not Islamic regime, you have to change everything, why these judges are there? Well, where are good judges? You show us and we're going to use it. We are going to use it. And the same thing about Amir al-Mu'minin. Even the rulers that he appointed here, and the Amirs, were just many of them ordinary Amirs, of course. Because, of course, you could not find for every city, or for every, of course, you could find for every state one very committed person, but not for every city. And that's why usually the good intention, the good knowledge and good quality of the leader would not go down to the hierarchy of administration. And therefore there's always an ongoing effort to create a good administration through a process of time. So, now, then he continued, لا مليء والله بإصدار ما ورد عليه. I swear by God that these judges are not capable of going out of what has been presented to them, out of the entanglement of the problem. ولا أهل لما قرر به. And they are not fit for the position that they have been given. لا يحسب العلم في شيء مما أنكره. One other thing, since their knowledge is very limited, they think this is the whole knowledge. And if anyone speaks something beyond what they know, they think that they don't know anything. They are very quick to reject whatever they don't know. So they don't regard anything to be knowledge beyond what they know. وَلَا يَرَى أَنَّ مِنْ وَرَائِمَا بَلَغَ مَذْحَبًا لِغَيْرِهِ. I never think that someone else might have more knowledge than them. وَإِنْ أَظْلَمَ عَلَيْهِ أَمْرٌ اِكْتَثَمَ بِهِ لِمَا يَعْلَمُ مِنْ جَهْلِ نَفْسِهِ. If a problem is put to him and he doesn't know it, he just conceals it. He doesn't say that I don't know. Because, of course, he knows that he doesn't know it, he doesn't want to discuss it, he doesn't want to reveal his ignorance. And therefore, because of all these qualities, تَسْرُقُ مِنْ جَوْرِ قَضَائِهِ الدَّمَاءِ. Lost lines, lost bloods, are crying against his unjust verdicts. Because he doesn't know. But all these are on the assumption that he has good intention, of course. If he doesn't have good intention, that's a different issue. All is on the assumption that he has a good intention, but of course he is not capable of this position. And therefore, despite his good intention, the lost lives, blood of people are crying against his unjust ruling. وَتَعَجُّ مِنْهُ الْمَوَارِيثِ. And the property, inheritance, that about which he is going to judge, are grumbling against him. إِلَى اللَّهِ أَشْكُو مِنْ مَأْشَرٍ يَعِيشُونَ جُحَالًا وَيَمُوتُونَ ضُلَّالًا. I complain to Allah. Of course, to whom he can complain? He couldn't come because there was no one above him. He should have appointed many people like these people. So I just complain to Allah from a group of people who live ignorant and die with misguidance. لَيْسَ فِيهِمْ سَلْعَةٌ أَبْوَرُ مِنَ الْكِتَابِ إِذَا تُلِيَ حَقَّ تَلَاوَتِهِ. For them, nothing is more worthless then Quran, if it's recited the way it should be recited, if you go into the deep knowledge of the Quran, exact meaning of the Quran, they don't care about it. They don't want to care about it because they don't have knowledge of it. So nothing is more worthless for them than the book, if it is read the way it should be read, the way it deserves to be read. وَلَا خَلْعَةٌ أَنْفَقُ بَيْعًا وَلَا أَغْلَى ثَمَنًا مِنَ الْكِتَابِ إِذَا حُرِّفَ عَنْ مَوَاضِعِهِ. Now, the same book would become very valuable for them. In fact, nothing is more valuable for them than the book if its verses are removed from their place and are given a wrong spin and interpretation. وَلَا عِنْدَهُمْ أَنْكَرُوا مِنَ الْمَعْرُوفِ, nor anything more vicious is in their eyes than virtue. وَلَا أَعْرَفُ مِنَ الْمُنْكَرِ, and nor anything would be more virtuous in their eyes than vice. Of course, it's a very graphic description of some of the judges who were appointed at his time. Well, it's a very abstract description, but it gives the impression that at his time some judges were appointed who had this type of qualities, or they lacked the true qualities of a judge. And the final sentence, of course, is the final couple of sentences are very strong, that for them virtue is like vice and vice is like virtue because of their ignorance. So this is very important. The ignorance has placed them here. Now, this is, if you match this with the next sermon, which again talks about rulings, religious rulings, Sharia rulings, at his own time, and the way he categorizes people, would give us a type of more or less clear understanding of what was going on in terms of judicial system and in terms of jurisprudence in the time of Amir al-Mu'min. Usually we think that until that time there was no jurisprudence at all. It was just traditions of the Prophet going around orally, because of course it was forbidden to write it down, so orally going around and people were just acting according to the traditions of the Prophet. Whereas it wouldn't have been possible. You can't expect that to happen in an administration. Certainly there was an administration in place. Certainly there was a judicial system. And certainly there was a system for understanding or creating the law. And of course that law was based on the Quran and on the Sunnah of the Prophet. Nevertheless, there were people who had to decide about what they understood from the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet at that time. Even at that time, at the time of Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam. I mean, this is about 30 years after the Prophet, peace be on him. Now, even if you want to understand the text which is about 30 years before you, you are in trouble. You come with lots of differences of opinion about it. And that is why the Shia always say there should be someone who has the final say, who has the real authority on the book and on the Sunnah of the Prophet. In fact, the whole concept of Imama is for safeguarding the Sunnah of the Prophet. Usually we think that Sunnis are those who go and stick to the Sunnah of the Prophet, and Shias are those who go and stick to their Imam in place of the Sunnah of the Prophet. And certainly this is a completely wrong type of picture of the situation. What the Shia say is that if we want the Quran to be understood correctly, if we want the Sunnah of the Prophet to be preserved and understood correctly, you need some sort of immaculate authority to tell you that what is the right interpretation and what is the right meaning of a verse from the Quran or a tradition from the Prophet. And in this way, the Sunnah of the Prophet is preserved. And therefore, when you go to the traditions of the of Ayyam alayhi salam, all the time what they are emphasizing is that you have to stick very closely to the Sunnah of the Prophet. And even if they disagree with Qiyas, juristic analogy, against people who, of course, very well established at the time of Imam Sadiq as Ahlul Ra'i, you will see the whole argument was about the Sunnah of the Prophet. In this way, we are going to lose the Sunnah of the Prophet. Now, here, Amirul Mu'mineen talks about, again, people who were called Ahlul Ra'i, the people of opinion. And why people of opinion? Because, of course, we were entangled, Muslims were entangled at the beginning with a very serious problem. And that problem was, Islam expanded very rapidly. In fact, it couldn't catch up with the cultural expansion. It went, the territorial expansion went very fast that the cultural expansion could not follow. So they were faced with many cultures, with many new questions. The amount of wealth coming in, booties of war and kharaj and other things, was creating a new economy for which there was, which created lots of questions in itself, and for which no answers were prepared. And therefore, you would see that people could not find rulings about everything with which they were faced in the Quran or in the Sunnah. And therefore they said, okay, what should we do? So we have to create an opinion which is closest to the Quran and to the Sunnah of the Prophet. And this was later on developed into the system of Qiyas, which of course is used by more or less to different degrees by all Sunni schools of jurisprudence, by all four Sunni schools of jurisprudence. The idea was, of course, very impelling in the way that we have come by new questions, we are faced by new questions, the answers are which we cannot find in the book and in the Sunnah. You shouldn't think that this is a new problem, because you usually think that this is a new problem in the new modernized society. No. It was exactly the same thing. And the center for all these discussions, of course, was Kufa, which was the point of conjunction of different cultures. Soldiers coming from all places, all different areas of Islamic territory, very big Islamic territory at that time, camping in Kufa and in Basra. And then, of course, you will find all these different cultures having different questions, and therefore the jurists of Kufa were completely different from the jurists of Medina. I mean, in Medina, you have Malik ibn Anas, you have jurists of Medina who were very strictly following the traditions of the Prophet, and they said, we don't need anything else, we don't need opinion. They were people of tradition, more or less, although later on, of course, the Malikis as well, they used Qiyas due to exigencies of the time. However, in Kufa, right from the beginning, you see that Rabi'a al-Ra'i and Abu Hanifa, they used this Qiyas very freely for several reasons. First of all, they were not in Medina. The traditions of the Prophet had not reached them as reliably as it should. And Abu Hanifa himself, he did not rely on many traditions. It is said that Abu Hanifa only relied on 17 hadiths from the Prophet and regarded all others as dubious. He said, we don't know whether they are reliable or not. So he had to use other sources, and that was, of course, Qiyas, a systematic type of opinion, creation of opinion. So using this type of method of putting in reason, which is the source of opinion, of course, into understanding the Sharia, was something which Muslims faced right from the beginning. And interestingly enough, or ironically, The people who opposed this to save the Sunnah of the Prophet were A'imma alayhim salam. Categorically they opposed the use of opinion. Now, the question was, if you don't use opinion, then how you want to find out rulings for new issues? And the answer was, well, you do not read the Quran well, and you do not read the tradition well. If you read them well, if you understand them well, if you have someone on whom you could rely, then you find answers for all these questions. Now, here Amir al-Mu'mineen is expanding on this issue, elaborating on this issue, and is very harshly condemning this type of use of opinion. And the reason is self-contained in the statement of Amir al-Mu'mineen here. So the title that Sharif al-Razi gives to this khutbah is "Fi Dhamm Ikhtilaf al-Ulama fi al-Futya," condemning the disagreement of ulama in their fatwa. Now, of course, it comes against us as well, isn't it? That our ulama also disagree in their fatwas. So, what should we do? Now, there's one difference here, and that is, you might have differences of understanding the text, and therefore the result will be difference of opinion, of fatwa. However, sometimes it's not differences of disagreement in understanding. It is disagreement in just an opinion put forward for a fatwa. Not resorting to the book, not resorting to the tradition, because you say you can't find it there. So you use your own opinion, and then you, of course, disagree, because you can have as many opinions as number of the people that you have, if you allow this. And this is why, actually, the use of qiyas was stopped at the time, and it was restricted to the four schools, jurisprudence in Sunni world was restricted to four schools, which was a good thing. And that was actually putting a stop on using the qiyas. And all other mujtahidun afterwards, later on, they had to rely on the qiyas of Abu Hanifa, or on the qiyas of Shafi, or on the qiyas of Malik, not using their own qiyas, of course. It was good. They found that there was something problematic there. Otherwise, you could have as many Arab schools of jurisprudence, as many jurists that you would have. So, وَفِيهَ يَظُمُّ أَهْلَ الرَّحْ. In this khutbah, he disparages the people who used opinion in juristic issues. وَيَكَلُ أَمْرَ الْحُوْقِ فِي أُمُورَ الدِّينِ لِلْقُرْآنِ. And he, in this argument, he puts the ultimate ruling in juristic issues for the Qur'an. He says that everything should be referred to the Qur'an, and Qur'an, you have to understand it. Everything is there, the only issue is that you don't understand it. Now, I was looking into the commentary of Ibn Abi al-Hadid, because it was very interesting for me to find out what does he say, because he is certainly a Sunni scholar, he should believe in qiyas. And categorically the khutbah rejects qiyas. Of course, the term qiyas was not used at the time of Amir al-Mu'min, it was used later on, and then at the time of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, it came to be organized very systematically, and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq rejected this. And you see this line coming from Amir al-Mu'min down to all A'imma. The same type of argument was put against this type of practice. So, although you don't find the word qiyas here, but you would see that the issue, the origin of the issue, is addressed here. تَرِدُ عَلَىٰ أَحَدِهِمْ الْقَضِيَّةُ فِي حُكْمٍ مِنَ الْأَحْكَامِ. فيحكم فيها برأيه. When a problem is put before any one of them, sorry, I lost the code of my discussion. I was saying that I was interested to see what Ibn Abi al-Hadith says about the khutbah, the rejection of the qiyas. He says that our companions, of course, the companions of the Mu'tazila, they think that this khutbah could not be true. Amir al-Mu'min could not have been against the qiyas. But he himself doesn't pass a ruling, because at the beginning of Nahjul Balagha, he himself says that no one can doubt any khutbah in Nahjul Balagha not to be from Amir al-Mu'min because of the style. So he himself keeps quiet. He said, just our companions say that this cannot be true, because Amir al-Mu'min could not have been against this practice. Otherwise, how could they practice it? Someone like Ali was against. So, taradu ala ahadihim al-qadiyya fi hukman. A problem regarding a certain issue is put before one of them, one of these judges, or one of these jurists. فَيَحْكُمُ فِيهَا بِرَأْيِهِ. He passes a judgment according to his own opinion. ثُمَّ تَرَدُ تِلْكَ الْقَضِيَّةُ بَعَيْنِهَا عَلَى غَيْرِهِ. And exactly the same case is put before one other jurist. فَيَحْكُمُ فِيهَا بِخِلَافِ قَوْلِهِ. And he passes the ruling completely contrary to what the other jurist had passed the ruling about it. ثُمَّ يَجْتَمُوا الْقُضَاةِ بِذَلِكَ عِنْدَ الْإِمَامِ. Of course, it's not only two different jurists give different opinions, and then all of them come and are present before the Imam الَّذِي اسْتَقْضَاهُمْ, who has asked them to rule in this case. فَيُصَوُّبُ آرَاءَهُمْ جَمِيعًا. And he says, all of you are right. Now, of course, this is alluding to another very, very crucial and important basis and pillar of Sunni jurisprudence. And that is that كُلُّ مُجْتَهِدٍ مُصِيبٍ. Every mujtahid is right. And the reason is that the mujtahid had used his opinion, his efforts, to find out the ruling of God. If he makes the mistake, what is his fault? Now, Amir al-Mu'min said his fault is ignorance, of course. So he shouldn't have used his opinion in this. Now, the very, very important concept in the Sunni jurisprudence, which is, of course, dealt with in Shi'i books of jurisprudence and usul al-fiqh in great detail, is that, is every mujtahid right or not? Now, the Sunni jurisprudence says, yes, every mujtahid is right. Because if it is the ruling, if the ruling is correct, he gets two rewards. If the ruling is incorrect, he gets one reward. And in many cases, they say there is no ruling for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The ruling comes from the mujtahid. So every mujtahid should be right, actually. So, he says that they go to the Imam, الَّذِي اسْتَقْضَاهُمْ, who has asked about their ruling, فَيُصَوُّبُ عَرَاءُهُمْ جَمِيعًا, and he approves of all those opinions, وَإِلَاهُهُمْ وَاحِدٌ, and this is why their God is one, وَنَبِيُّهُمْ وَاحِدٌ, their Prophet is one, وَكِتَابُهُمْ وَاحِدٌ, their book is one. أَفَأَمَرَهُمُ اللَّهُ سُبْحَانَهُ بِالْإِخْتِلَافِ فَأَتَأُوا, as Allah ordered them to disagree, and they are obeying him. أَمْ نَهَاهُمْ عَنْهُ فَأَسَوْا, or has he prohibited them to disagree, and they are disobeying him? And then, of course, he goes on to put forward other arguments against this issue, which is called taswib. It's a very well-known concept in jurisprudence. Taswib means that we give correctness to every opinion issued by a mujtahid. And this is why all these even polemical issues have come about. For example, they somehow purify all the companions by saying that, well, they were mujtahid. So if Muawiyah fought against Ali, Muawiyah was a mujtahid, Ali was a mujtahid. and they fought against each other. And you see where this would lead. If Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad killed Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he was a mujtahid, Imam Hussein was a mujtahid. And in this way, Amirul Mu'mineen says, and this comes to the very position that some people have today, that yes, all of them were right. And Amirul Mu'mineen says, how could it be that all of them are right? And all come with different opinions. And their book is one, their prophet is one. How could it be that, for example, how could a religion be so fluid that Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad could be right and Husayn ibn Ali could be right, Muawiyah could be right, Ali could be right? I mean, how could it be? And people kill each other and we say that both of them were right because they were mujtahid. And then it comes to these very type of dramatic consequences that we can see even in theology and in polemics of theology. So the rest of the argument we leave for next week, just to leave some time for questions and answers, inshallah. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi.
You know, you mentioned that the caliber of the judges was such that it was not to the standard of Imam Ali, and he still had to use those judges. And when they judge on an issue, how would the victims or the person who was killed by the judge, was there a mechanism whereby they could go to a superior judge?
Yeah, there was always an appeal. And the final appeal was the caliph himself at all times. Of course, when I say Amir al-Mu'min had to use the same judges, this is my guess. I mean, it is not conceivable that there were this caliber of judges at this number that Amir al-Mu'min could appoint in all cities, for example. Probably, if Amir al-Mu'min had the chance, he would have trained the judges of that caliber that he actually was satisfied with. As we know, I mean, these issues of state and administration always take lots of time. And these Western people have somehow spotted this point very cleverly. And as soon as you create a state which is independent, they know that this state cannot survive until it establishes itself and creates its own system of administration the way they want. And it takes 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. And so what they do, just right at the beginning, they say, okay, you are using the same people, for example, you are using the same methods. Where are your standards of human rights? Where are your standards of democracy? This is the same dictatorship. I mean, it's very clever type of tactic. And in this way, no disagreement could be made against, I mean, those who have this power of propagating these issues. About Amir al-Mu'min as well, I mean, we could imagine the same thing would have happened. I mean, many of those Khawarij, who were the extremists, so to speak, they demanded the same thing from Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi salam, that, okay, where's the justice? Where's that Puritan type of faith that you were talking about? Why are you allowing, for example, the Salatul Taraweeh to go on, for example? Why you do not stop this? Why you do not do that? I mean, all these things you could imagine could have come up very quickly against Amir al-Mu'mineen. And different sections of society, one part the extremists, the Khawarij, demanding Puritan type of life. The other part, of course, were the people who did have the know-how and the administrative type of caliber of people. They had their own type of problems with Aminul Mu'mineen. So always it's like that. Always it's like that. I mean, I can feel it because I have lived with it, with an administration in Iran which has tried to tackle all these issues. Not that I have been a part of it, but because I have followed every piece of news very closely. And I know how these things are pose problems towards any person with very good intention, even very good knowledge of how to do the thing, but the time which is needed for it is usually taken away from it. But Alhamdulillah, I think Imam Khomeini has been much luckier than Amir al-Mu'min, in the sense that he was given that time, and Amir al-Mu'min was not given the time.
You were talking about the situation in Iran after the revolution. I can speak, I think, with equal emphasis on, and equal truth about the situation in the city that I was born in India, Hyderabad, which was the only independent state in India after the entire India was colonized by the British. And we had a different system of law prevailing in Hyderabad. But because of human weaknesses and because of the corrupt nature of people in power, the judges who were appointed in the smaller, what would you call it? I don't know, villages and rural areas and the subsections of the larger state of Hyderabad were such incompetent people. And these people, actually, some of them were from my family and they were from the elite of Hyderabad, Hyderabadi society. And because of nepotism and because one elite family favors another, and there were such idiots and there was such great injustice done to the entire population that it was beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was a state which was not there was no upheaval. It was an independent state, and it had its own legal system. The British hadn't imposed it was slightly adjusted, changed slightly, because of the overarching power of the British in India. But, you know, everything was in place, but because of the human element, these judges, we were only talking, my husband and myself the other day, how stupid some of these, how nasty some of these people were, how ignorant, and the whole community and the family really respected them as they were and gave them such status. Even though they were really not at all capable to carry on the task
for which
they were
earning
such huge salary.
Yeah. Anyway, all of us are human beings, and human beings have always these problems with them. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Just quickly, how would one become a judge in those days? Was there a course they had to go to, or was there a book they used to refer, just like we have today?
Well, as far as I can get, there should have been a system, certainly. But as far as the history would tell us, is that usually people with knowledge of the Quran and tradition, who could analyze issues and infer a ruling from that, were appointed as judges. And these people did not go through a type of madrasa or anything, or a school of judges. They were somehow well known by the foreign knowledge. And in fact, as far as history tells us, it might not be right. I mean, our understanding won't be right. It was an individual type of effort rather than a type of established systematic production of knowledgeable people in every field. And therefore, when a person became knowledgeable and had certain qualities like commitment, like adala and taqwa, they were appointed as judges usually. It's good.
I want to ask a question that since the occupation of the Imam, we've been in a situation where the world has progressed in Islam has progressed, both in terms of geographical movement and, of course, modernization and things like that. So, currently, in the UK and Europe, there seems to be an opinion going around that Islam in the Western society and in this context would not be the same Islam as the Islam in the time of the Holy Prophet in the Arabian Peninsula at that time. And so what needs to happen is a process of going back to the Quran and the Sunnah and reinterpreting it all to come up with a new Islam for this era and this place. And additionally with that is that there are no sort of mujtahids that come from these areas at the moment. I mean, type of marja of people that could give these opinions. So, a preferred solution has been to get a, if you have an issue, then you have a sort of discussion process whereby all the people are sincerely discussing in order to find the root. And through that discussion process, any illegitimate opinion would be filtered out until you reach a consensus opinion on a certain issue. I assume that these people that do this kind of thing would have knowledge of Arabic, but might not be mujtahideen in the way that we classify them nowadays, like in the 13 years in Qum or in an Islamic feminine. What is your opinion on this? Is this the same kind of thing that we're talking about here? And the other thing that they say is that because there is no imam, we have the freedom, if you like, to do this. And if we're wrong, then at least we've tried our best in the absence of the imam, in the absence of any sort of alternative. Because to start producing marja from the West will take maybe 100 years or something like this. So, what's your opinion on this?
Well, it is right and it is wrong. I mean, all these issues have a point in it. I mean, why these opinions come up? Because there is a point there which would cause the creation of some problem, and then these points come up. It's right that, of course, you cannot live like the time of the Prophet, and the very clear reason for it that you do not live like the time of the Prophet. Do you? I mean, very clearly, you do not live in a society with a closed type of economy, living on a type of industry which is not developed at all. Then, of course, you do not travel by the same means as they were traveling. You do not eat the same food. Many issues. And some people, of course, have taken the Sunnah of the Prophet wrongly, trying to imitate the Prophet in these issues. And for example, they say the way the Prophet dressed himself, we have to dress the same way. The way the Prophet ate, for example. But of course, these are very trivial issues. They don't say, for example, we have to travel the way the Prophet traveled, isn't it? They do not travel on camels. I mean, it's a confusing issue. I mean, they want to imitate the Sunnah of the Prophet in the wrong way, but of course they certainly cannot do it the way it was done at the time of the Prophet. Otherwise, they never should ride an aeroplane, or they never should use a computer, something like this. I mean, if you want to strictly go according to the Sunnah in this sense of the word, you have to be like Ahmad ibn Hanbal. You shouldn't ever eat watermelon, because he said, I haven't found that Prophet ate watermelon, and I don't want to somehow disobey his Sunnah. So this is a wrong impression of Sunnah that we have. So we are not living like that. However, there are certain standards and certain rulings in the Quran which does not relate to these very, of course, apparent aspects of society, and have some bearings on our society and our life, and have become problematic. Now, what, for example, the issue of marriage and divorce, for example. The divorce should be in hands of men, and women have no right to divorce. In modern society, it causes problems. The issue of of Qisas, for example. It causes some problem. The issue of diyat, compensation, it creates some problem. And all these issues that I mentioned, I can recall what type of commotion it created after the revolution in Iran when they wanted to implement every single of these rulings and make them part of law of the country. However, the whole point goes back to what Amir al-Mu'mineen said. You have to read the Quran correctly, not superficially. And this is what Imam Khomeini as well brought as a method of his own jurisprudence, saying that you have to read these things correctly to get the ruling which is fitting for the time. And he says, if you read them correctly, you would find that a ruling is passed for a certain setting, and you are taking that ruling out of its context, and you want to use it for another setting, which Allah has not ordained that. And therefore you need a new ruling for it. Which again, for that you have to go to basic values of the Quran to find that ruling. So it somehow revolutionized the whole system of ijtihad in the Shiite thought. But it doesn't somehow strike the mind of any jurist unless they are faced with problems of the society. And unfortunately, most of our Jews are not faced with those problems. It was, of course, Ayatollah Khomeini who was faced with huge problems of administration of the society. I mean, for example, we had a problem of Employment Act, the workers' rights, for example, after the revolution. Now, you know, according to the Islamic law, any contract which is made by the satisfaction and free will of the party, both parties, should be approved. And no one can stop that contract. No government can stop that contract. So, if you are a worker, and I am a factory owner, if you come happily to me and say, look, I work 12 hours a day for you, and you give me the same wage as others give to those workers who work for 8 hours, then who could stop this contract? I mean, legally, according to Sharia, this contract should be binding. And government cannot interfere in this contract. And then, is this the type of system which works in an industrial society? I mean, you have huge work power, manpower, which are workless, which are jobless, and you can exploit that very easily. You can employ workers to work for you 14 hours a day because they are desperate. And government cannot do anything about it. So, after the revolution, the Majlis, the parliament, wanted to pass a law to somehow give government some right to supervise these contracts. So they wanted to bring an Employment Act that, of course, employment should be according to some rules, 8 hours a day, for example, the minimum wage. It's not just whatever the parties agree, there should be a minimum wage. All these are against the traditional jurisprudence, okay? Now, how they went about it, of course, it took several years to solve the problem. And certainly you would expect that many jurists come in and say, no, you should go according to Sharia. Now, the whole point of Imam Khomeini was that this is not Sharia. You are understanding it wrongly. You have to go again, you go back to the Quran, to the tradition, read it again, to find out that Sharia does not allow zulm and injustice. And therefore, at the beginning, what they said was that, okay, the government should provide these factories with water, electricity, energy. Okay, can come as a third party and say that I only supply energy to a factory provided you observe these rules with your workers, with your employees. And gradually it evolved, and of course it was all the full force of Imam Khomeini behind all these Otherwise, it wouldn't have happened. It was impossible for such things to happen in Iran. Yes, of course. Although we have traditional Sharia, but that traditional Sharia should be brought into the new context and understood in the new light. So, it is right, but there should be a Jewish who could do this, not an Orientalist who could come and say, well, look, this is how you have to do it in the modern world. It doesn't work like that. I mean, people never listen to an Orientalist or to an expert from Soad University coming and telling them, this is the way you have to do it according to your own Sharia. It's not possible. The whole mindset of Jews should change. And it's not opinion, it's going back to the roots again and understanding everything in a new light.
I think one of the comments here as well is we had this idea that in Europe is the modern, in Iran they have airplanes, mobile phones, and all the things. I mean, it's just as modern a society as you find over here. They don't have the same vices, and they're not any less modern.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to necessarily come to Europe to find answers for modern values. They're all about, in a modern country, you can give you the answers
yeah.
you wish to listen.
Yeah. They even have uranium enrichment now.
Sorry, one very quick question. You said Abu Hanifa relied on 17 Ahadith.
Yeah.
Can you give the source for that? Because, I mean, if you went to a Sunni brother and told him that, I don't think he would agree with you, because you find that baffling.
It is a very well-known fact, actually. I reread this in Ibn Abil Hadid. But I can bring several sources that Abu Hanifa did not rely on any Ahadith, because he said they are all new. In fact, he said we cannot rely on Khabar al-Wahid. This is all going back to the issue of whether we could rely on Khabar al-Wahid, on isolated one single hadith or not. And therefore Abu Hanifa said we don't have many mutawatir hadiths and we can only rely on them. I'll bring you the sources, inshallah. Okay? Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad.